I have a little case study for you. This dog's name is, I'm going to call him Kai, that's not his name. And I saw him day before yesterday, Friday. So even little dogs or big dogs can be dangerous. Now, the fact of the matter is that in a shelter, at least at Marin Humane and down in Santa Cruz, we had a tendency to put small dogs up for adoption, even if they were a little iffy, because they can't do much damage. But it is very good to remember that they can do damage. No, they can't do very much. They're not like a big dog. They're not going to be able to do that. But they definitely can do some. So this little dog, Toy Aussie, he was rescued from a hoarder, and he was placed with a person who was pretty experienced. She's a very nice woman. And she called me after she'd had the dog for about 8 weeks. So he couldn't settle. His problems that she said is he couldn't settle. He barked almost constantly. And you know, all know what Toy Aussies look like? They look like a cross between an Aussie and a Pomeranian, and indeed, that's probably what they are. You know, they're not like, they don't have generations going back of purebred Aussies. And as a matter of fact, anytime you take an animal and you take a largish animal and you breed them smaller and smaller, you get hyper behavior. And so Toy Aussies are even worse than mini Aussies on the hyper behavior scale. At one point, Pomeranians were 40 pounds, and they probably didn't act like her. The Queen Victoria had them, I believe. So anyway, he barked constantly, almost constantly, and he'd bitten the foster once on the hand and threatened her a couple of times. And so when I'm over there and I'm talking about the bite and whatnot, I'm thinking small dog bite, right? Kind of not that big of a deal. But he was, she had him in the back room when I first came in. She brought him back out a little bit later, and he did not like me at all. He did like her. He had liked, in the rescue, he had liked the foster he had been with for a month. He thought she was pretty cool, but nobody was really handling him a whole lot. And then he went to this guy. And he was affectionate to a certain level. In other words, you know, you could be affectionate to him, but he did not want to have his paws touched. She got, her bite was when she went to get something out of his paw, and he nailed her. So he bit her pretty hard on her hand. And the other bites were probably something close to that as well. So he also seemed to have some, we were talking about the problems with a dog not feeling well. He had neck sensitivity, which to me is kind of I don't want to say it's a hot button, but you know, I think a lot of dogs have neck sensitivity because we put collars on them and then we yank them around and then they yank us around, but they're using their neck when they do that. And so he had neck sensitivity, so when she tried to pet him on his neck, then, or to put his collar on, it would be difficult to do that. So his primary method, he's very leash reactive to other dogs. He got along okay with the dog in the household, who was another very fearful dog. And my first thought when I arrived was that the dog that came up to visit me was the dog I was coming to see, because he came up and started snapping at my feet. But that was not that wasn't the dog I was there to see. So yeah, happens all the time. Yeah. And so and she kept going, oh, this one's fine, she'll be okay. So I gave her a treat and she almost took my finger off. And I really don't have a tendency to give dogs treats right away. In this case I did, and I can't tell you what my thought was why I did it. So she brought the little dog in. So he played too roughly with her. He liked her okay, but he played so roughly that the other dog was beginning not to like him. And I mean, we're talking about a 9 pound dog, 9 or 10 pound dog. He's a little guy. So, and then his other thing is he wants to play ball all the time. So he just constantly playing ball and playing ball and playing ball and playing ball. So here's a little video of him. I've gotten permission to use this video. This is not a nasty video. This is just him with his energy.
How old is he?
He's probably 6 or 7. he did come from a hoarding situation, and before that he was with somebody else, and of course they thought he was abused, but as we know, you know, probably abuse is things that people think that other people do, but that it doesn't happen quite as often. It does happen, for sure it happens, but it, so here he is.
Was the other dog the same size?
Yeah, the dog is another little dog. Come on, I got him. There it is. So this is just his energy. He wants to go outside. He can't settle. And this has happened, she says, all the time. Just all the time. He collapses at night. And here he is playing ball with the husband.
Wait, does he like the husband?
He likes the husband. The husband never does anything bad to him. So he has truly, you know, he has bonded to this family. There's the other dog.
So he kind of doesn't know what to do with his energy, so he keeps moving.
He keeps moving. He can't stop moving. I mean, the reason I'm kind of bringing this up is because I think this is a really bad problem. Yeah. This inability to maintain a balance to a lower level of energy.
How long did she have?
They'd only had him 8 weeks.
Yeah. 8 weeks?
Yeah. They've only had him 8 weeks. And they're still a foster. They're not, they didn't adopt him yet.
So this is the foster he did.
Yeah, so this is a fostery bit. So one of the big issues is that she can't get his harness on because he gets really irritated when she does that, but she wants to go for walks with him. And, you know, if you put something around the neck of a dog who's got neck sensitivity, you're just going to make it more sensitive and then you're going to cause problems. So she got him a really nice harness, the kind you just step into like this. But he'd flip over and then try to not get it on, you know, do the wiggly butt thing and all that. And so I said, okay, well, why don't we try to, you know, I'll try to kind of use a lure for him, and I'll put some, he was taking treats from me by this time, and I put some treats, like, on the table, but remember, he's pretty short. So I put the treats on the table, and she started to put the thing on, and he couldn't reach the treats, and he was really wiggling and whatnot. So I took my hand, and I put my hand down to his level, just like this. And so he took a treat, and then she tried to do it again, and then he took a treat, and then he nailed me right through my hand. Ooh. So it was like, okay. My, ow! And luckily, it didn't hit a nerve or anything like that, but it was a really, really dead serious bite. If he had been a big dog, it would have crunched my hand. So this is one of the reasons I'm saying, you know, be careful, realize that small dogs can be dangerous. They can actually, and particularly if they bite your hand. Mm-hmm. So this was a deciding factor for her because she was thinking she couldn't keep him, and she says, I can't keep him. And I said, no, I don't think you can keep him. And she said that she thought the rescue would probably euthanize him, and I said they probably would. And now I'm feeling bad about it because I think with, you know, a really slow desensitization program, with extremely careful people who are not going to let the dog out in the yard and all that kind of stuff, he might be okay, but he barks all the time, which is really difficult to deal with in our society. So it's possible that the only thing he has left is, you know, euthanasia.
What about medication?
I don't know that they're not going to be willing to do it. So we've got now the situation with the rescue having to decide what to do because they're not going to keep the dog because they're afraid he's going to bite one of their friends. Yeah. And they can't take him any place, and the neighbors are barking, or, you know, and you put a bark collar on that dog, and what's going to happen? You're going to terrorize him. So you get into this thing where you're going around and around, and I see you, I'll in a second. So the situation is that, I mean, if they put him on something like Prozac, you'd still have to find a good owner for him. Yeah. So they're in the middle of just making this decision, and I'm sorry about the decision. But, you know, and I certainly didn't report the bite, but somebody will. So he's going to bite somebody, and somebody will report it. And that will, you know, kind of do it. Yeah?
Would she,
I got this new harness. I can't think of the name, but it's, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a brand new one. It comes like in three pieces, and it's a smaller dog, like the Freedom. So it's...
Yeah, I think I've heard of it. It's like a balance harness or something like that. It's a, yeah. Yeah, but the problem is that at this point, is there are other things that are that are just as important. Not that that's not important. It's very important. Being able to clothe your dog, being able to get your dog ready to go for a walk is extremely important. And, you know, but it is also a situation where this dog, it's the thing we talk about in the behavior evaluation course. There is a huge difference between a dog that has an owner and a dog that doesn't have an owner. And a dog that has an owner has and is someone who's going to stick with him and is able to do management and is able to do some training and whatnot, that's one thing. But a dog that is in the limbo that occurs when a dog is in a shelter and there's no steady person to work with them, because what they need in a shelter is one person or at most two people to work consistently with the dog to help them get acclimated and desensitized to human beings. He doesn't trust people. He has a really good reason for not trusting people. But he's also in pain, and the vet can't examine him. You know, because as soon as they go to examine him, he tenses up and he's got a muzzle on, and now you're not going to be able to feel any of the places that have inflammation. So, it's a really icky situation. Yeah?
Do you think it's something to do with the way his brain is wired, too?
Wait, what?
Do you think any of it has to do with the way his brain is wired?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have now seen about 4 or 5 toy Aussies, and I know there are a lot more out there, so I know it's just a little smidge. But they all have these problems, these same problems. High arousal, inability to drop them there to mitigate their own energy, and the barky thing, you know. And they bark more than she does, and she barks, you know. Yeah.
So if, let's say that they were just like, we are keeping this dog, and we're going to work with this dog, how would you start out? What would you do, like, okay, you're going to do the relaxation protocol or whatever. Like, where would you start with this?
Well, that's one of the places you'd start. First, the first thing I'd do is I'd put him on a really, really strong schedule.
Yeah.
And then after that, I actually wrote up some stuff, but it's down towards the end of the PowerPoint today. But yeah, I'd put him on a really strong schedule so that he can predict what's going to happen at what time it is going to happen. I'd start doing slow desensitization with touch. I don't think I'd worry at all about taking him for a walk right now. I would do probably the protocol for relaxation. I would do either a sit or a down protocol and really start teaching him to do that. Now, there are lots of different ways you can do that. You don't have to do it Karen Overall's way. You can do it other ways as well. But they're all geared at increasing focus and enhancing relaxation. And over a long period of time, and I'm talking 6 months to a year of working steadily with this dog, he's going to get better. Now, how much better he's going to get, I don't know. The problem is he's got a high bite reflex, and when he bites hard. Mm-hmm. Those are a lot of dogs, when they have a really fast bite reflex, but then they kind of go, you know, that's what Flocka would do, or some of the other dogs that I've seen, the little dogs. But when he bites hard and down. I mean, I've got four punctures. So he, you know, he's a tough little nut. But yeah, he would get better. But I don't know many people who would do it. You know, at any given week, I usually have at least one person who says, I need to rehome my dog. How can I do it? And this is why I don't, you know, and I've run out of people. You know, the ranch never did exist, and you know, and I've run out of people. You know, do you want this? But no, I mean, I know a lot of dog trainers, and you know, if you ask the dog trainers if they want to adopt a dog that has problems, most of them will say no. In fact, most dog trainers want dogs that are pretty bomb-proof because they want to be able to use their dogs when they're dealing with their client dogs. Oh yes, that's why they got into dog training. The vast majority of people get into dog training because they have bad, they have dogs that, yeah. I mean, that's why they do that. That's why I did. And then you find it fascinating and you keep on going on it. But it's really tough. Yeah.
I don't get too Aussies and they're not toy, but they're my problem child. And I take them to places where
So you can see forever?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And they charge, and one of them, I mean, they're gentle in the car, but they're high energy. And I've gotten to the point where if I have them on leash, they're not going to jump around. But off leash, they're, you can't contain them. And I work with other dogs, like a golden retriever, that I have to tell the client I had to worry about the safety of the other dogs I have around me. So I keep direction in a group. And I don't know, they still have the same issues. They're high arousal.
Yeah, it's all over our dogs now. It isn't, certainly isn't one breed only.
No. I constantly correct them, and that's all I do. And I play a game where I have them all sit, and I take a picture, and they have to sit and order down, and I give them a treat after, and they like it. They think it's fun.
Okay, so what you might do with that is you might have more of those, more interrupt times, where times where you, they're
I do it randomly.
Yeah, good. And then do it for a long time.
A long time?
Yeah, do it for like 2 to 3 minutes.
Okay.
Instead of, you know, just 30 seconds. To start extending it. The other thing I think that's really important here is that remember that all most of our clients think that high energy is good.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't. You know, it just isn't. It is something that all animals have, but
the golden retriever that I couldn't work with anymore and have tantrums in my car when I wasn't in the car because he was excited about the dog.
He was so excited, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gonna skip ahead really quick here, and then I'll go back to these other dogs. Okay. All right. So this is actually you don't have this anyway. I put it up today, it's on the website, so you'll have it. But we may as well talk about it now, and then we'll go back to some more case histories, okay? So I think the most important thing when you go with regard to energy is the animals don't distinguish between how they feel and how they act. So what that means is when they feel something, they act on it, and they act on it immediately, which is why when we're trying to teach something like inhibited behavior, it's so difficult for them to make that. When, you know, so maybe you know somebody who, whenever they get offended, starts to write an email immediately, you know, about, I guess you guys all know somebody like that, yeah. And then, you know, they have hopefully learned over the years that you better not press send for a while.
24-hour.
Yeah, you need, well, a dog or a cat, I mean, that doesn't come naturally to us, right? And it certainly doesn't come naturally to any kind of animal. They do not get the whole idea of a cooling off period between the impulse and the action. So this is why the teaching of wait is so terribly important, because we have to take over doing that from them. And so, you know, if you came up to me while all of my dogs were ready to come out and play, you know, and so they're all sitting in the back of the car and they're waiting, and I open up the back of the car, they won't come out until I tell them it's time to come out. They won't. They'll just stay there. In fact, sometimes I'll say okay, and they go, "You really mean that? I'm not sure you really mean that." So you know, that is one of the places we really work hard. All the dogs are not allowed to get out of the car until they are given a release word. It's extremely important, and that is part of the "I want you guys to be nice and relaxed before we jump out of the car." So, you know, that's a PREMAC principle, isn't it? Before you do this, you must do that. And in the case of our dogs, probably the best PREMAC principle there is before you do this, you must relax. So if you had a very small shelter, for instance, and you were able to have the dog do like a 30-second sit stay before you walked them out of the kennel, as opposed to looping them and just getting the hell out of there because there's all these other dogs that are barking like crazy, then, you know, you could start teaching those dogs some impulse control. But you also just teach them focus, and I think it's really important. So we and they are emotional beings who can think, but the thinking process comes after the emotion. And I think that's an extremely important consideration when we're dealing with reactive dogs of any kind. So the other thing that is scary with dogs is that we respond to sounds and sights. They respond to sounds, sights, and smells. Maybe the, remember the little healer I was talking about last week, that they didn't even have access to a window to see out the window.
Yeah.
And he's just listening and going whenever he hears something going, because his response is so rapid with this. And they're doing well, by the way. They're starting to get the whole cool down period going. So that's really, really important. Stress is natural, but long-term stress is not. And that this is where I think it's really good to talk about that little Aussie. That amount of energy with such a small amount of rest and relaxation between each of his activities would indicate that he's very high stressed. Do you think? So he's trying to get rid of all this excess energy all the time by spinning and barking and barking and spinning and running up and getting a ball and all that kind of stuff. So he has got high stress. Well, in the natural world, high stress doesn't last for long. If you've got a predator, they're just kind of hanging out in the brush or whatever, they see something happen, they go after it, they either get it or they don't get it, and then they go back to where they were before. So it is, if you think in terms of conservation of energy, it's really helpful. That in the wild, an animal will only use up energy as long as they need to before they go back to a quiet, calm state, because that's how they're conserving their energy. So if you know, that study of the 1,940 pariah dogs, and found that 90% of the time they sleep and 10% of the time they find they go foraging for food. I mean, that's completely opposite to the way we think dogs should be. We think dogs should be like up 80% and down 20% or whatever. And really, they're down 90% and up 10% if they're living in a natural environment. So conservation of energy is really important. Well, our spinning little nutcase dogs are not conserving any energy at all. And so they're very, very unbalanced. I hate using the word balanced and unbalanced because Cesar Millan uses it all the time, but it's really true. You really want them to be balanced. I was rereading Mark Rashid's book. Have you ever read his books on horses? They're really good. Mark Rashid, R-A-S-H-I-D. A couple, Aspen, don't bother them. Aspen, don't bother them. She says, I'm not bothering them. I'm just walking. And I didn't bring your bed, and I didn't bring your bully stick, and you know, life sucks. Poor girl. I'm a bad mom. So yeah, now where was I?
Mark Rashid
had, right. And of course, horses are prey animals. So they don't have the fight part that our dogs have quite so much. They have some, if they're cornered. But since most aggression is fear-based, it's really good to read these books, because he really talks a lot about fear and how horses are with fear and how, you know, you work with that and all. And he's got like 6 or 7 books. The one I just finished reading is called Whole Heart, Whole Horse, Whole Horse, Whole Heart, one of those two. And then he does Aikido, so he kind of does the
energy.
Yeah, he does a lot with energy. So I think it's always really good to read about other species, because we get so fixated on the dog should be doing these things. You know, the dog should go for 2 walks a day. The dog should do this. The dog should do that. That we forget that sometimes that one dog or another might not should.
Yeah.
That might not be part of that dog's needs, and so that's a really important consideration.
In some of the dogs that I've walked or worked with, I see that people don't really understand arousal, because they think if a dog gets stressed, that's one thing, but if they play ball forever and the dog is like,
they think they're excited and happy.
And that's great, except that I'm like, except that's also arousal. That's also, and then you build it up, and even if you think it's positive,
yeah,
that dog pretty soon, it's so
they become an adrenaline addict.
Yes, exactly.
And I have a lot of clients right now that are adrenaline addicts, yeah. And we actually build that into our lives, which I'll talk about in a minute. So If you go back to, again, wild animals, the consequence of a high burst of energy is going to be, you know, there will be a consequence. If they run away, they will escape. Then they can relax again. You've all seen these pictures and or these movies in Africa where they've got lions right next to the antelopes, and you're going, well, that's predator and prey lying there together. And the reason is because the predator is full, and the prey know that. So they're not about to waste energy moving away from the predator when they don't need to. So again, thinking in terms of energy, it starts to make a lot of sense. So we got running away, freezing in place, which is, you know, one of the responses, or running after. So those are all the things that they can do, and all of those have immediate consequences. Aspen and Heather are running along or trotting along a path. They see a squirrel. They go, boom, go after the squirrel. The squirrel gets away, obviously. And then they come back and they go, okay, we're going to trot away again. That's very natural. That is very, very natural. What would not be natural is focusing on that squirrel and not being able to leave the squirrel and barking at the squirrel and trying to get up the tree. And there are dogs that do that. There are dogs that really have that behavior pattern. So what they're doing is okay, not preferred.
For that, that's
but it's very okay. Yeah, it's okay. It certainly expends energy the way nature intended to expend energy. And so, you know, that when we say that a dog has an adrenaline junkie, they are. They get wired with this adrenaline and also dopamine. The two of them together go together to create this cycle of energy and enjoyment. And what we don't want is that to happen. So cortisol also is put through the system when they're in arousal, and the cortisol takes a long time to drop down, as we've talked about before. So this is why people say, he bit me and then he looked like nothing happened. You know, this whole thing where somebody, a dog goes, ah! And then they're like, we're done. You know, that's all. Because that is that expenditure of energy that is then dropped immediately. And if a dog has a relationship with you, after he bites you, he feels sorry because he really didn't want to hurt you that much. But if you didn't do that, it would be okay. You know, it's all your fault. Does sound familiar? They're not people who do that kind of thing, are they? Okay. And calming chemicals include serotonin and GABA. So you guys may have heard of a drug called gabapentin.
Yeah.
And that is supposed to be a calming drug for dogs. It's also supposed to calm nerves. They gave it to me for my trigeminal neuralgia, and it didn't do a thing except made me confused. So, you know. But those are the calming chemicals. So when we give Prozac, then you don't actually increase serotonin when you give Prozac. It's a reuptake inhibitor. So essentially, the amount of serotonin in the brain, it stops it from leaving the brain. So it actually causes a buildup of serotonin only by not letting it leave the brain. And that's why Prozac works sometimes, and gabapentin works by actually adding GABA to the system to try to calm down the dog. Of the two, gabapentin is the less, I don't want to say less effective. They don't have to be on it all the time. You don't have to wean them back off or whatever. That's not necessary with gabapentin. So when we reinforce excited, energized behavior, especially when we arrive home, we may be reinforcing the very behaviors we do not want to see. So in our world, typically what happens is people come home from work. It doesn't happen in the morning when you get up because you've been there. Remember one of the things that dogs need more than anything else is companionship. So you, even if you're sleeping, you are being a companion to the dog. So when you get up in the morning, you don't get this huge spurt of energy, except for if it's a puppy, and then you might, and especially if they're in a crate, then you definitely will. But if when you come home from work and you're tired and all that, and you walk through the door, the dog goes through a paroxysm of greeting behaviors because they've been alone all day. Their primary need for companionship but they haven't had the companionship they need, so they're really needing you, and they get really, really aroused. And so what most people do, or many people do, I don't know if most people do, is they say, okay, I'll take you out for a walk. So what are you doing there? you're reinforcing the arousal that happened when you got home by taking the dog out for a walk immediately. And if you take the dog out for a run, you're reinforcing it even more. So in our house, we've gotten into a rut, which we now have to get out of, where somewhere around 4:30, Flocka decides it's time to play ball. And they all know that they get a ball playing session in the afternoon, but we've always been careful about making sure the dogs are nice and relaxed when we decide that it's time to play ball. But now Flocka is going, I'm ready, man. So she takes her little ball and she goes around and she whines at us. She's like, and then she'll get up on, she gets up on these stools here, and she'll get up there and she'll have the ball in her mouth. So she's just, I need to play ball. So yesterday we were talking about it and we decided, well, we cannot do this anymore because what's happening is it's going to get earlier and earlier, and we've seen this, earlier and earlier and earlier until she's like, you know, because she wants that high that comes from playing with the ball. And again, we've always been very careful about not giving the dogs what they want when they want it. They should get it when we want it, not when they want it. And so now we have to adjust it. It's amazing how easy it is to fall into the trap. Because it's really cute. Oh, look, she's bringing her ball to us now. Isn't that cute? And then all of a sudden we've got this dog that does this.
The companionship that the dog needs, do they only get that from a human, or do they satisfy each other with other canine?
It actually depends entirely on the dog. There are some dogs, like this little one right here, obviously is very happy that he's in your lap, right? Yeah. So that dog is getting companionship for you, from you. Some dogs are more dog-oriented and they get companionship from the other dogs, and some dogs are more human-oriented. So it really depends on the dog. I asked you to think about what your dog's perfect day was like. What'd you come up with? Some people actually sent it on. Anybody?
Lots of sniffing.
Lots of sniffing, yeah. Yeah. So.
Ideally somewhere new.
Okay. Yep, that sounds right.
Hanging out next to you.
Isn't it amazing what they want? They want the companionship.
Sleeping, sniffing, ball.
And in that order.
But we have control of the ball.
Yeah, but it's still sleeping. Isn't it? And you know, you think about the feral dogs and you go, maybe this is right.
Like a nice walk or an off-leash hike and kind of playing with other dogs that aren't too like on Scorpion on her.
And she's pretty young still.
She's pretty young, so she loves to run around with other dogs. She just doesn't want them on her. Like, we can go to the beach and most of the dogs are doing their own thing, so it's perfect for her.
Yeah.
And a little flirt pole.
And if you think about a beach, think about dogs walking along a beach. There are some dogs playing, but what are most of the dogs doing? Sniffing. They're just walking along and sniffing. Yeah. And if you amble, they amble. If you walk really fast, they amble. Because they want to investigate everything.
Yeah.
So off-leash walks are obviously best because off-leash walks allow the dog to sniff and they get the companionship that they need at the same time. I think a lot of shelter dogs are distressed not only because of the high amounts of arousal in each and every shelter that I've ever been in, but also because they're deprived of companionship. And I mean not play groups. I mean, because that's a high activity, high arousal activity, and it's not bad for them, but they need to probably relax with people. If they grew up with people, they probably need to relax with people. But, you know, there are certain things that just can't be done, and at least not the way things are set up nowadays.
Is that where, like, kids coming to read to the dogs can help?
Yes. Yeah.
Just to have somebody there.
Have somebody there. That's extremely important to have somebody there. That's one of the reasons why it's nice. I have one client who has a very nasty little Maltese. And, oh, he's nasty. He bites a husband on a regular basis. And the wife is just dotes on him. So I come over, once every 2 months or so I have to go over for a psych session. I mean, because I can't do anything else with the dog, because they can't do it. But in the end I said, how about having him, because whenever he sleeps in the bed with them, and, or he has, we tried to move him to a crate and he just made noises all night. So now he sleeps in another room, and then at 5 o'clock in the morning, he comes in and whines until she lets him up on the bed. And then she puts him up on the bed, and then if the husband moves, he bites him.
Oh, God.
So, I mean, it's just, it's
a barrier.
And the husband is such a nice guy, and he's like, I really want my wife to have this, you know, it's his second wife. And I really want her to be happy. She couldn't have children, and I really want her to be happy. But for crying out loud, does the dog have to bite me? So we ended up having the dog sleeping right next to the wife on a pillow, on a table.
Oh, that's good.
So the dog is high, feels like it's got some companionship. She can throw the blanket over the dog if she wants to, and the dog does like to be on the blanket. For those of us who have Chihuahuas, Chihuahuas always want to get under the covers. There's no question about it. Many little dogs do, but certainly Chihuahuas do. So. And that's a compromise. That's what we've done with that. But that is companionship. And I think that sometimes we forget how important that is to dogs. So a dog that kind of explodes when you get, you know, when you get home, he's been lonely, and he's been not necessarily understimulated, but he's had enough sleep, and now he's ready for something else. So if I were to give, you know, if I thought that my clients would do this, which they probably wouldn't, if they would come home, ignore the dog for 5 minutes until the dog has calmed down, then greet the dog by getting down on the ground and really being huggy-kissy with the dog, that's fine. And then doing about 10 minutes, maybe, of obedience, and then walking the dog. And what you would do then is you would relax the dog, make him feel like you're still with him, everything is good, life is generous. Then do some obedience, so we get a reminder of who is boss here and who is not boss here, and besides that, that works their brain. It's not even besides that, that's the primary thing, it works their brain, and then go for a walk. So now you've got, it's like I've always said, dogs should always go on the second half of their walk. Skip the first half.
What do you recommend when you have, like, so for instance, my daughter gets home, and then I get home a little bit later, and then my partner gets home a little later, and there's so much excitement
each
every
time.
Single time. And so I'm just like, just leave him alone, but the dog, you know, like, even the older one actually is just like, whoopee, happy to see you. But how do you, like, so then you have each person come home and do, like, wait, and then do a little bit of a leave, like, you would still do that with each successive person?
Yeah, if you could.
Okay.
Yeah. Anybody else got any brilliant ideas in that area?
I mean, it's fine. We can totally do it. I'm just curious. Yeah.
It really should be that the dog thinks you've been there a while. That's why you do the ignoring. So you're ignoring the dog so that they start going, oh, okay, you've been here a long time. But honestly, most people screw that up like crazy because they want to greet them. In fact, I had somebody say that to me last week or the week before. And I said, okay, ignore the dog when you come home because he's just really crazy. And she said, but I want him to have missed me. Okay. You're going to have to accept it as it comes then. Yeah.
One thing that's working for me is when I come home at lunch, the dogs are crazy. I let them into the yard, which is all fenced and closed. Then I go in the house for 5 minutes. And I come out another door. And they think I've just been in the house.
See, that's a really good one. Yeah, that's a really good one. What I used to do when I lived in Corte Madera is I would come home. I had the three really big dogs then, and so they get excited. Big dogs getting excited is kind of. And I would walk through the house, go out through the back door. They all come after me, pretend to empty something into the garbage, leave them in the backyard for a few minutes, and then they thought that I was already there. So yeah, it was just kind of like this process. It's like, oh, I'm doing something, you know. I'm giving myself a job. Which is one reason why with some people what I suggest is that you walk in, you never use a threshold, right? You never say hi at the threshold if you possibly can. Walk all the way in, go to the kitchen, clunk the cookie jar so they know that it's there, have them sit, have them do a 30-second wait, and then very gently give them a treat. And if they take it, like, then have them do another sit and wait, because they have to get to the point of taking it gently before you'll let them release them. You can really tell how adrenalized a dog is by how they take a treat, you know, depending on the dog. Some of them just take it like, oh my God, whack, and you go, oh, that hurt, you know. Okay, so we have to figure out how to help unstable dogs become balanced. Look at Aspen balancing up there. So a predictable routine, lots of sleep, lots of, remember that the dogs are polyphasic sleepers. So they wake up, they go to sleep, they wake up, they go to sleep, they wake up, they go to sleep. This is very normal. They don't just sleep. A balanced feeding schedule. They should know that when food is coming, they should not be free fed, because free feeding takes away that balance. They need to know what's going on. One of the things that Mark Rashid was talking about with a crazy horse he was actually trying to, or when he was a kid, his boss was trying to rehabilitate, because the horse had been very, very badly treated. And so I thought this was a really cool idea, actually. This is for fearful dogs. What the guy would do is he started feeding this horse on a regular schedule, twice a day. So he'd get food and water twice a day. But he'd wait until the food and water dish were completely empty before he would feed him the second time. So he knew how much the horse ate. And he wanted to make the horse hungry, not starving, just hungry, before he fed him again. And what he was doing is creating need. So he's going, not only do you need me, but I am going to fulfill that need. It's going to happen. And this is one of the things that people who free feed miss out on, you know, is that the dog, or the horse in this case, knowing that they need you. And after a while, what happened is the horse would go on all the way to the other side of the pen every time he came in to feed the horse. He then started coming up to the middle part of the pen, and then eventually came up to the gate to start accepting, saying, oh good, my food is. And then he would start, and then he asked for being touched. And they don't like being touched as much as dogs, but like being touched, but it's pretty good when they do. So anyway, those books are really good. So balanced feeding schedule, obvious leadership, not dominance. We all know that dominance and leadership are not the same thing at all. Dominance is getting what you want when you want it, and leadership is deciding which way we're going, how fast we're going, and where we're going. Those are the things that we decide when we're a leader. The goal, the speed, the direction, all those things are the things that we decide. The thing that I've used on a lot of dogs, which is helpful for dogs that are kind of, maybe have had adrenalized actually, any kind, is puzzle solving. So I had this one client that we came up with a whole bunch of different puzzles. She lives in Sausalito, and she couldn't take her dog for two dog walks a day. She could take her for one. And she'd done a lot of obedience. This is the only client I've had in the last 2 years where she tells the dog to go sit on the mat, and the dog goes and sits on the mat when you come in. But the dog sits on the mat and quivers and shakes and, you know, just is like, and then as soon as she says okay, the dog goes, because it's like winding up something and then just letting it go, right? But the dog is somewhat fearful and also has gotten caught under the house like four times. And once it gets caught under the house, it can't figure out how to come out. She can't figure out how to come out. So we thought, well, we can't kind of eliminate that under the house. In this circumstance, we can't, because this was a rental. So what we did is we put a blanket, and then we put a, we first of all put a treat under the blanket, and we had her burrow under the blanket by holding it up until she went and got the treat. And then we started putting her under there and having the treat on the outside. So she had to burrow through the blanket all the way to the outside to get the treat. And it was actually a really good game for her, because she got, instead of getting panicked when she went under the house, she would start to think, and then she could figure out how to get out from underneath the house. Because they had to literally take a part of the deck off to get her out from underneath the house when she was there before. So it's actually very cool. So burrowing under blankets is a really good game. Trying to figure out, where the treat is, that's a good game. You don't have to buy these stupid puzzles. Those things, the ones you buy, it takes them 10 minutes to work it out, and then they're bored with it. If even 10 minutes. They were doing it at this wildlife place I was at yesterday. They had, in the raccoon area, they have this rather... this box, and it had all these latches on it and locks on it and everything. And I said, I bet you hide food in there. And he, she said, yeah, this was supposed to be one of our enrichment things. He, she says, it took us about, took him about 30 seconds.
Yes.
Got it. So it didn't work. So in thinking about things like patience exercises, what else might you think would be a good exercise? Yeah. And do you think it's really working?
It's really working.
Mm-hmm. And that's with Mick?
Yeah.
So Mick, by the way, is a somewhat reactive healer. He's better now than he was before. So what do you think the walks have really helped with?
Adrenaline. Just because he would go out, his whole walk was looking for what he could kill, what he chased. Yeah. And now he's learning to sniff because I'm going so slow that he's bored that he eventually will put his nose in the grass. And that didn't used to happen.
Oh, that's interesting. So his default behavior was to look for danger.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're saying, don't worry about danger, get bored.
Yeah.
And then he starts sniffing.
Yeah, he's finally sniffing.
He's finally sniffing. That's actually really, that's sparking some stuff in my brain, because I think a lot of dogs might have to learn to sniff.
Because they're not allowed to sniff.
It's like we reverse engineer that sniffs too much. So if we speed up.
He should not do it, yeah. Speed up. If they sniff too much, then definitely speed up. But, you know, one of the things that I recommend for aggressive dogs all the time is nose works.
Yes.
I mean, and there's a couple teachers I really like and up here. And it's a fantastic game for aggressive dogs. I had one client with a aggressive golden retriever, a tripod. And after nose works, he just stopped. He was fine. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah?
I was just going to say, with dogs that can't settle, kind of like they're a little toy Aussie. And
he's not mine.
And also this little Chinese crested that I saw a couple weeks ago, who could not settle down. The article that you sent came at the perfect time. It was exactly what she was saying in terms of speed of the walk, that some dogs get more adrenalized on walks where they're go, 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 as opposed to these slow walks. And so it's a good strategy to just get them to use a different part of the brain than to make them equally as tired, just partially physically and a lot mentally instead.
Yeah. And of course people don't want to do that because they think the dog needs exercise.
Yeah.
Well, they don't realize that the dog needs the whole body exercise.
So she was saying to me, she was like, so should my husband take him on extra walks every day? Because she was trying to get her husband to just retire out of the house. And I said, I'm really sorry to tell you this because I know you want to get rid of him, but actually, no.
Go get rid of him!
Because he was home driving.
Oh, I see.
And I said, I actually think your dog might need less walks and then slower walks as opposed to extra, you know? And it was the same concept of like, slow down, use a different
slow dog. Down, yeah. Yeah. Just because we think, I mean, people who want to put their dogs on bicycles or run beside bicycles because they want the dog to get exhausted. And people who send their dog to daycare because they want the dog to be exhausted. Yes, the dog is going to be exhausted short term, but it's not solving any kind of problem. And then the dog actually ends up liking daycare more than it likes home, which happens all the time. It's an interesting concept. Any other suggestions anybody's got? Yes?
What about the use of things like T-touch or massage?
Those would be very good. You know, T-touch is wonderful. Have you ever tried T-touch?
I haven't tried it. I've seen a few people using it, and I've been very interested.
Yeah. T-touch is really worth it. When it first came out, it's Tellington Touch, and the woman who invented it or developed it, she first worked on horses and then moved on to dogs after that. And when it first came out, I know we got really weirded out because they use a kind of wrap on the dog. Yeah. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
It's like bandaging, like ace bandage, and they kind of wrap it around the dog. And what they said was that they were trying to make the dog more aware of his body. And at the time I thought that sounds silly, but I think now that it's possibly a good idea. The thing that I loved that they did, and I used to do with Strider because he was leash reactive, is they started to teach him to understand what his body did, how his body moved. So they use PVC piping, And they put it in all different kinds of permutations on the ground. It's all the way on the ground. And then they have the dog walk over it. And the dog has to figure out where to put his feet so it doesn't end up on the PVC piping. And the dog's concentrating on it. It's like sniffing. The dogs concentrate so much on that that they forget to concentrate on anything else. Just that moving from place to place to place. This is something I would do in a shelter. I would get, you know, so what we did at Marin is we took ladders and we put ladders on the ground in the pavilion, and we had the dogs learn how to walk over the ladders that were just on the ground. It wasn't like it was going to be dangerous at all. And at first, of course, they wanted to avoid it completely. And then after a while, they started to walk over it and they started to get more and more confident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually an exercise they do when rehabbing dogs with certain types of injuries. My dog is partially torn ACL. And it was, you know, learning where to put your feet.
Over.
And at first, you know, like, what do you do? I'm not going to walk on that. But then, like, you know, rewarding him for doing it. He loved it. Like, it was exercise. He'd get all excited. Actually a good thing.
Yeah, so they do, once they get, it's like anything else, you know, you start to play piano and you hate it, and then you get better at it and you love it.
Oh, this is fun, yeah.
Right? So this is the same kind of thing. So things like that where the dog's concentration goes from whatever it was on,
yeah,
you know, to whatever, to something else is a really good thing. I mean, I think in our society right now, we just have this tendency to think in terms of physical exercise or rest.
Yeah.
And I think that there are many other things that you can do. These are sentient beings. You can help these sentient beings do all kinds of things if you can do it. Yeah.
I think things like kind of piggybacking on the summer walks. One of the dogs I walk is a Shiba, and she's highly aroused. Or they played with her with the red pointer light.
Oh, the laser?
Yes.
Oh, God.
So the dog, what we found was I actually asked her to get a T-Touch harness, and it's a front clip because she's done no training with the dog. And once we started teaching her not only some impulse, just waiting at the door made a huge difference, because the less she can, she would dart constantly. She was constantly moving.
Yeah.
And then her owner
said, they're like a fly.
Yeah, and her owner said, I didn't realize harnesses. I thought they were just so she didn't run away. Well, what happened was the dog all of a sudden couldn't dart everywhere. Then all of a sudden her arousal started coming down. She goes, now she even barks less. Because she would.
The anxiety wrap works that way too.
It was incredible, the difference in this dog. Now she can walk and the leash isn't tight. And it was simply because her arousal could, she wasn't constantly moving.
Well, the other thing about harnesses versus collars is that a collar actually encourages pulling. So as soon as you put a collar on, the dog tends to want to move forward. They're good because opposition reflex kicks in. So the dog starts to, you know, put the collar on, you pull back. People almost always pull back before the dog pulls forward. It's not a process where the dog is pulling forward first. And so you pull back and the dog then leans into it and starts to pull forward. And they do that with backloading harnesses too, which is one place where the article, they don't like, the Oslo group does not like front loading harnesses. They do not like them at all. And yet, you know, I personally think that the back connecting ones encourage pulling. So, you know, it's kind of a problem.
They now have new ones that buckle on the side?
Though the Sensation's always had a buckle on the side. And I've always used it. and a lot of times I'll do something in the front and the side, or the front and the back, mostly the front and the side. But yeah, I mean, there's no perfect piece of equipment that I know of at all. So, yeah.
Have you had any better luck with the health team one that you were testing? There's one that...
The problem with that one is that if the dog balks, it can come out of it. Yeah, the one I was testing, I liked it, except that the dog could come out of it. Honestly, this is going to sound awful. I'll probably take it out of the video. But pinch collars are almost the best. Even though you think of them as being torture devices, and you would never use them on an aggressive dog or whatever. But in a way, they're very comfortable because unless the dog pulls, they don't get any pressure. And then when they pull, it just tightens enough, if you're doing it right, for them to go, I guess I won't do that anymore. And then they pull back like that. If we could find a collar that was not invasive, and pinch collars are invasive, there's no question, and probably 99% of the people I work with, I won't use one on. But as far as the action of teaching the dog, if you pull, it's uncomfortable, so just pull back. It doesn't twist them here, it doesn't pull back down their neck, it doesn't tighten it, you know. It is, but, you know, as I said, I'll probably pull this out because that's an anathema thing, you can't say that.
So when they're used appropriately, is it just like a sense of pressure?
Yes.
They're not causing any pain.
They cause no, there's no pressure on them at all when they're using it properly.
Uh-huh.
It's when they pull. And you never, ever correct on them.
Right.
So that's what most people do, is they yank on that, and then that is, because you shouldn't. It's kind of just a, they pull forward, they go, not comfortable, I guess I'll back up just a tad. And it's like that, so it's like power steering in a way.
Do you think most people use them correctly? Or
no, that's no, and that's why, that's a major reason I don't very rarely recommend them.
Yeah.
Because you know, most of the time people, if people get pissed off, they yank the leash.
And their dog, they're not fitted properly.
Right.
Oh no, they have the one, they're so loose that they're all round, round, round. And then if they do that, they don't work properly at all. So you remember, Linda, when we were talking about equipment, it's how you use the equipment that is humane or inhumane. It's not the piece of equipment, you know. But I think that if you give somebody a piece of equipment that can be used punitively, they will use it punitively. But front-loading harnesses, I've seen dogs with shoulder problems with that, and sternum problems with that, and the halties, you know, the ones that go around here, neck problems, all kinds of stuff. So there are people, actually guide dogs was using it, they don't need more, but they were using corrections on those things.
The trainer in San Francisco that we talked about uses, he teaches every person that comes to him, sit.
And you correct with it, and you're using that with this thing that's going to knock their neck out. It's not good at all. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, with my dog, who has a huge fur and a big ruff, the prong collar just didn't do anything
because he you never found his neck.
No,
yeah.
You never found his neck. Front loading harness, he just pulled the whole thing to the side. And the back loading one, he pulled me.
So what are you using?
So what I do is I have a Freedom harness, I put the harness on him, and then I use the halting. And I just let him, I don't yank on him, but when he goes forward, I'm just going steady, so then the
halter will pull back like this. So that's what they're supposed to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
now the other thing you can do is attach a log to the back and just pull it really.
I actually got to the point the other day where I took the
halter
off and I could just use this harness. And he's getting better. But when I did that, he was,
My German
huge.
Shepherd Strider, I swear, my shoulder was he would take this it off. It would be gone. When I got him, he'd probably never been on a leash before. Or if he had, it had been very briefly. Yeah.
First of all, small dogs, I prefer on the back.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Because they could trip.
Yeah, you can't use a front loading harness on the dog, small dog. Yeah.
And then with bigger dogs, the front. But I had a client that had the choke collar, or you know, the prong, and they kept tightening it, so the more he didn't listen to them.
Oh my God, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
if they can use a punitive collar punitively, they will.
And I told them 2 to 3 finger lengths.
Yeah.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be able to move back and forth on the neck. It should sit still, because if it moves back and forth, it'll rake. And if you want to be very good about using it, you put the little little rubber prongs on the end, so that softens it up considerably. Yeah, that softens it up considerably. So there are also horrible ways to make it worse. If you can sharpen the prongs, you can flip one so it's one prong in, one prong out, and that makes there be more space between the prongs, which causes more damage. I mean, people do the most god-awful things, and so they can misuse every piece of equipment that is there. But I would never ever use a prong collar on a small dog. I would never use I don't put front-loading harnesses on small dogs, back-loading only. I have particular ways of teaching no pulling with small dogs that is different than with big dogs, because small dogs can pull too. You know, they very definitely do. Yeah.
What age, if somebody's dead set on getting a prong collar for a larger dog, what age?
At what age?
Yeah.
Probably 6 months or so. Yeah, you want to make sure that they're, but, you know, you always try not to put anything, you know, not to use one. The collar I want to use on all dogs is a martingale. That's the one I like the best. That's my favorite collar. And I do have the burner I was talking about. Their previous trainer put the dog on a prong collar, and she was like, I don't want to give this up. And I said, you don't have to, it's okay. Yeah. So what we did is we got bit, but he's a very exuberant dog, and he broke the prong collar. Prong collars can break very easily. The prongs just come out like that, because they're, you know, they sit in like that, and they just twist and pop, they're gone. So I suggested to get a martingale and the prong collar and attach the leash to both of those, and that keeps it safe, you know. So I don't know how we got into the equipment, but anyway.
Can we go back? How do you teach a small dog how to walk in it? How have I not seen that before?
It's on your website. No, I'm not holding out on you. I usually just use the two leash method. So I just let leave a dragging leash. So I'm holding, because they're all the way down there and I'm up here, right?
Yeah.
And I'll have them walking and I'm going to reinforce them where I want them to be. And then if they start pulling ahead, I just put my foot on the dragging leash and they stop and then they look back at me and I go, oh, come on back here. And then they come back over here. And so what ends up happening is you're just using this dragging leash to put it, and they can both be attached to the back of the harness. You have to make sure that the leash that you're holding is always very loose or slack, not loose, but, you know, so it's just, you do need to have some kind of dance moves in it.
Yes.
It's like, this is papa, all right. But it works, and especially if then you reinforce the dog for being where you want him to be. I also use guided walking for small dogs, that method, where you start walking, and it's hard to do because, again, small dogs are, I always tell people, if small dogs, it's your fault you have a small dog and you have a bad back. That's what happens if you have a small dog. But with a small dog, if you want to go for a walk and they start going ahead, if you drop the leash down and turn around, that works for them pretty well as well. So that's one of the methods I use for them. Okay, so do you, stranger danger, dogs that are fearful and aggressive towards strangers, do you allow greetings? Or do you not? Okay, so if you do not allow greetings, what happens? The dog is really freaked out, right? So dogs really are naturally curious. It's one of the primary emotions in a dog, is that curiosity. So somebody comes into the house and they really want to greet that dog, that person. Yeah? So if you don't allow it at all, then at what point does the dog get used to people? Or what do you do? So you know how people on the path always go, you know, oh, can I pet your dog? And you're like, no. Don't touch the dog. The dog might not be good for you.
I started telling people with Fiona, because she can be very friendly, but she doesn't like hands on her all the time, especially kids. So I just said, you can ask her. And you get really funny looks. And I'm like, you can just stand there. And you can kind of go like this. And if she comes up to you and she's being very affectionate, you can like let her smell your hand. But people look at you really strange. But I'm like, you can ask her if she wants to greet you. Because she's not a girl.
I bet
not.
They do look at you.
They
right
do.
Now.
But I, so then you, and a lot of times there's kids. And so then I really try to explain to them, not in baby talk, but very, just say, you know, she likes to kind of make a choice. And we have to just go very slowly with her. And I mean, in other words, but.
Okay, so.
And that tends to actually, people, because it's weird, and people go, okay. And then it actually makes them think about it. So,
okay, so that's how you do it, but so this is out on walks. This isn't in your own house.
Yeah.
What does everybody else think?
My dog just naturally likes to meet new people, but I do at your house.
No, this is on a walk.
On a walk, well, I usually, you know, kids run up and I say you have to ask your mom first, and then you have to ask.
And your dog does like to meet them.
And then I show them how to meet the dog, yeah. Okay, go down and usually listen. But he likes kids.
I think the concern is if your dog is in conflict, right? Especially if there's treats involved. So if the dog wants the treat but doesn't want the contact, then
the dog may override his natural desire to keep a distance, a safe distance, because he wants the treat, and then when he gets close, he might react and do something inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So I think at certain times, you need to make a decision for your dog and not allow your dog to make the choice, because your dog needs to know that you're going to take care of him and that you're going to protect him from those sorts of things.
Right.
So I think sometimes.
Yeah, I think I'm probably pretty antisocial here, but for me, consistency with the dogs is more important than anything else. So I just don't let people greet my dogs. You know, if they want to greet my dogs, I tell them I'm busy. I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry. You know?
When you look at, you know, they're not really missing out on anything.
No.
They need to do it.
Yeah.
Why bother?
And even though, you know, Aspen would meet everybody, Flocka doesn't want to.
So I mean,
Strider, my German Shepherd, he met everybody all the time. And I mean, he was the most social dog in the world. And he just kind of came that way. But by and large, I think that, you know, if you've got a fearful dog or a dog that has any kind of issues, then your primary behavior modification technique should be consistency. So if the dog can meet some people and not other people, then how are they supposed to know who they're going to meet? And if they do meet them and they get, and you know, you can tell people till you're blue in the face, be nice to my dog, and they think being nice is hugging them, right, or petting them on their head or whatever, then you're telling your dog, I'm not taking care of you. So, you know, and again, I think I'm pretty antisocial.
So you think giving the dog a choice?
I don't give the dog a choice. We're just going on.
Let people come up.
Nope, we're just going on.
Okay.
I just going on.
Depend on the dog. Like, my dog would do anything to say hi to every single person. And it's, if for her, it's very enriching. I'm not worried about her, but if she ever showed any fear, I wouldn't let her meet anything.
And you probably would just stop right there. So that's the way with Strider. He was always good with everybody. And so I didn't really worry about him. Except for, you know, if they had a small cat in their pocket.
In their pocket.
Carly's muzzled, so it's very conflicting to people because her body language is so soft and I want to meet you, and they're like looking at her like this, but she's got this muzzle on, and they're always like, why? And they ask, I appreciate that, why is that on? And I said, you know, it's for bad dog owners who don't leash their dogs, that's why. Not for you, she likes you.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's really funny because a lot of the time the behavior modification that we would tend to want to use is modified when there are other people around, because we're trying to impress the other people, or we're trying not to disappoint them, or we're trying not to make them mad at us or whatever. So, but it, I mean, to me, it's just that one of the things that I think should be taught in classes and is not necessarily taught in classes is not how to say hello to people. Not that that's a bad thing, you know, to sit and accept being petted by a person, but how to pass other dogs and people without having to interact with them. And in order to teach anything, you have to be really consistent in one way before you add the variable, right? So if you're gonna teach sit, you have to teach sit in one spot and then another spot, and then another spot, and then you can start to generalize, and so the dog now starts to begin to understand how you've generalized. But if you're teaching a fearful dog, you have to teach them one thing only for a long time until they start to become comfortable, and then you can start going and adding other things. So that to me is the most important thing. And if you have a fearful dog, a fear aggressive dog, then what they're gonna do is they're gonna pop back into that as soon as something really weirdo happens. So that's why one of the reasons I think it's really important to have this consistency of, no, we just pass people. So our current walk, which is fraught with poison oak, but at least doesn't have too many foxtails, nor does it have cows. I got to work on my cow thing. You come on out. You can walk with me and the cows. It's fine. I really don't want it. Heather would just go after a cow in a heartbeat. So I would have to be unleashed the whole time. Yeah. She would go, oh my God, oh boy, this is fun. Because she's got corgi in her. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know she's gonna go, oh, look at that hawk. Yeah. I think I'm gonna just go bite that hawk. So anyway.
So if you have a dog that's not neutral when you're seeing other dogs, but not aggressive, just like so excited, and so you're just basically working on the basic obedience, and you're working on impulse control, but they can't like for instance, they can't hear you. You know, once they start focusing, the hearing is gone.
Yeah.
Right? And we're just so excited. And it's not like I'm gonna go get you. It's like, oh my God, there's a dog. Like, what's your best way for it's just working on impulse control and like,
yeah, I mean I'd be working on control. I'd be probably be taking the dog to some place where they see a lot of people and from far enough away that the people aren't going to try to
But not people, like other dogs. Like people, she's like, well, whatever.
Yeah, well, other dogs go to the outside of dog parks and teach her to do a sit stay in the outside of dog parks.
Yeah.
I mean, that I think I've mentioned before that that's what I did with Strider because he would get so aroused around dogs that I took him to flyball classes.
Yeah.
And he had to do downstays outside of flyball classes, which are the noisiest, most obnoxious classes that ever got put on earth. Anybody here been to a flyball class? Oh my God! The screaming and barking, it doesn't stop from the beginning of the class to the end. There is no end to the noise.
Well,
and Strider had to learn to lie down and actually do a Zen down near that. And boy, did he get good. After a while, he got really, really good. So is unquestioning obedience good or is it even necessary? This is actually a really philosophical question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very deep.
Yeah. It's just something to think about. I mean, you know, we do have our, I'm calling my dog and the dog is going, oh, I'll get back to you on that, you know, stuff like that. How because we can't ask another sentient being to be unquestioningly obedient. If they're in a fire and you say sit, they should not sit, right? They should actually make up their own mind what to do, and that should be to get out of the fire. So, you know, when we're asking for that kind of stuff, how much should we ask for? And, you know, I saw this guy with his two border collies last week, and he's a really, really nice guy, and he says, I want 100% recall. And I said, well, you're not going to get it. And he goes, well, why not? And I said, well, when your wife calls you, do you always come? You know, you're just not going to get it. And so he now thinks that maybe 90% is going to be okay. So, you know, but yeah, this part.
It forces us to like learn what our dog's cues are too. Like I have a pretty lazy, happy, friendly dog, but squirrel cat. But I've learned what his tells are, and I've learned like I always have the right shoes on, and I'm not talking on the phone, and like we don't like I'm paying attention just as much as he's paying attention, so that. I don't have to ask for that unquestioning obedience.
Yeah, you're there for him. You're providing a kind of guided leadership. It's leadership with a lot of kind of influence and more than just leading. Yeah?
No, we're not.
Okay.
Maybe I'm just doing this wrong, but I have a dog that's really friendly, and one of his impulses is to always run to greet everyone, which is a problem.
Yes, not everyone wants to be greeted like that.
He needs boundaries, and so they started using a e-collar, and we're doing it consistently, and they say don't use the highest one. There's three levels. So I use the pager, but if he doesn't listen to me, I use the little vibrate, and it's working, but I told him I don't want to take away his personality, because I call him Mr. Social, or, I mean, he's like Scooby-Doo. He's just really happy, but when he approaches other dogs, especially owners of smaller dogs, they freak out. So
is he as big as Scooby-Doo?
He's not a great dude. He's like a German Shepherd pit bull mix. He's my...
Yeah, see, to me... I would be worried about using... I would be worried about using the e-collar there, because there's...
I hate when I feel that another owner or dog person doesn't have control of their dog. It's really overwhelming to me in my experience. Like,
yeah, they normally don't either. I'm not terribly sure that an e-collar is, I mean, I understand why you're using an e-collar. You're using an e-collar to get him to wait, to kind of, to pull back, right?
He comes right back to me.
It comes, well, okay, so it's for a recall. Is he stable? He's very social, you said.
He's the sweetest dog in the world.
Okay, so the last thing you want him to do is identify the pain of the e-collar with the person he's coming to see.
Okay.
Okay, so that's why the recall is working with an e-collar on a recall is appropriate, but working on a recall on a with an e-collar to stop the dog from being social, you have to be really careful.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah.
And that's why I have.
So we used to do it with Boo, our Aussie. It was we actually used treats, and it was a really nice method because he would do the same thing. He would go, "Hello world," you know, Aspen.
Yes,
come back over here. Oh, Aspen, you can work. Right? She goes, "Oh, all right, I can do that, yeah." So what we would be doing is he would see somebody here. I do this with her, too, actually. He sees somebody coming, and she's gonna do everything. So I'd see somebody coming, and you know, I might say something or I might not, but I'll go flick. And the treat goes back that way. And I keep moving. She's going to come and find the treat. Right? She's going to go find the treat, and then she's going to catch up to me. And then I'm going to go, flip, right like that. And she's going to go backwards. So that by the time I'm up to the new people, she's behind me. And then she's going to go, hello.
Nice.
So it's just a, you know, flip, there you go. And boy, did it work with Boo, the Aussie. He's like, this is the most fun game on earth. And we get all the way up. And because that charge, you know, that charge that they do was not available, because he keeps on going backwards. This is, Tricia invented this or developed it or whatever. And I just think that it's a really lovely move for dogs that are social, but a little too forward.
He gets depressed if I show up with no dogs for the walk.
Yeah.
And he only gets excited when he sees another dog.
So he's very dog focused. Yeah, well, try that, because sometimes that actually, she says, I'm ready for that. That one is good. I like that some more. So, you know, we just, and she now knows this movement, you know, that little back movement, which is the treat is going to go back that way. So that's where she looks.
I like positive reinforcement. This is their choice to use
people, so trying to do. This is very positive.
Educate.
And she's ready for more.
Yeah.
The other thing is it's almost invisible. Because you're walking out, you know, walking along, you're just doing that. You know, so the dog is staying behind you, but nobody's really seeing what's going on. And that's kind of nice because you don't want to have to be going, no, stop, wait, you know, or anything like that. So it's possible for that.
I have a question about training dogs' commands. And any of us could tell Aspen to sit and she would do it.
Right.
How does the police get their dogs to just take commands from the cops?
How do they
take commands from any other person?
Well, probably what they do is they never have anybody else but the primary handler giving the dog cues. And if you know, most of them train compulsively. So if another person gives the dog a cue, they might actually punish the dog for listening to that cue. So it would do a leash pop. It would be, you know, just kind of like, no, you don't do that. That's one of the ways they do it. Police dogs, by the way, are amazingly unreliable. Every year there are hundreds of dog bites by on innocent bystanders of police dogs. And we used to have a police dog, the police officer would bring the dogs into Marine Humane Society to do a demo, and they'd be in the lobby, and people would want to come up to them and say, don't come close to my dogs. So, you know, you think that there's one guy named Steve, God, I can't remember. He's a police dog trainer up in Seattle, and he does all positive, but he's one of a very few. Most of them are very punitive. The dogs are quite scared, and they often fear bite. So, yeah, they're not trained that beautifully. Yeah.
Do you ever think the use of them will be phased out, or do people get continue to use?
As long as they're
considered reliable enough.
As long as there's testosterone, there will be that kind of training. I mean, they just want it. They're from the police officer's point of view, that they're a tool.
Yeah.
They're not a sentient being. Now, the actual handlers are not like that necessarily, but the trainers, the way the trainers look at it is, they're a tool. And when a tool doesn't work right, you make it work right. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that they say, and I don't think it holds much water, but I've heard it in my clients as well, is, well, if I'm using treats in training, how can I, the dog will never do it without treats. Which, you know, you could fight back with that and say, well, if you use pinch collar in training, then my dog will never do it without a pinch.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, punishment is better than praise. Right. And I don't know why that is, but that's kind of how they think of it. So no, I don't think so. I think that it will maybe slowly get a little bit better, mm-hmm. but I think that there's always going to be a Cesar Millan. Yeah. There's always people who say, no, you just make the dog do it. You
but
know.
In terms of using dogs as police dogs, do you think that's something that was
really good? Oh, using dogs as police
yes.
dogs? Yes, because they're so valuable. And they, I mean, they really are. They yes, there are a lot of bites and whatnot, but they are extremely valuable. Not enough to override that. They have a huge intimidation component. You know, they're really scary. Yeah, they can be really scary.
And they also can't always call them off people. Sometimes they've really evolved.
Oh yeah, they don't. They because they go into arousal. Because it's got to be a game that has a start and an end. If you make it serious, it's going to get bad. All right. Okay, so this is, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes, and then we're going to do a consult, and then I've got a couple more case studies that I really want to get to. So, but if you're walking with unstable or aroused dogs, these are some of the things that I think are important. Walk with a purpose, create short-term goals. The purpose could be just sniffing, but it could also be we're going to have a goal here. So say you've got a reactive dog, and you see somebody coming, you create a goal in your head of what you want to do and where you want to go, and you just do it. And you do not, you know, you just go. Okay, so short-term goals are really good. Keep the dog focused on you and your walk. Teach walking games for high aroused dogs. Touch, spin, go rock, all the stuff that this is, that was in Santa Cruz. That particular rock was very fun, I think. they would all go. They all just, I mean, they still do it. They see a rock, they get up on it. Hello, here I am. And it takes them out of circulation. Other dogs can go by them. They stay where they are. It's a good place for them. For Luki especially, who's got the reactivity issue, it's a stunning way to work with him. Practicing avoidance moves and do not allow greeting of people or dog because they get so frustrated if they can greet some and not others. And what you want to do is take that frustration away, right? Your goal is to reduce frustration, increase the bond between you and the dog, and make sure that they understand that you are going to take care of them. And that's kind of really important. Okay, so let us, yeah?
I was just going to say, when I take my dogs out, I'm taking my dogs out for myself and the dogs. And I get annoyed people want to come over.
So do I. I think we're the same kind of person.
Yeah, it takes away our time and what we're doing. I'm here for them.
Yeah.
That's the whole purpose of
my risk. So the dogs are trained.
Yeah.
I've heard that an effective way to keep distance is to say, my dog has me.
Yes, it is, but it doesn't work very well. Because then they go, what are you doing out with that dog? So, you know, that's why I just say my dog's a jerk. You know, because Luke's a jerk. He's a jerk. Sorry, you know. He's he's got multiple personalities. Yeah.
Well, I always wear my, little bait bag that's clipped around my waist, and so oftentimes people will see, I'm giving treats.
Yeah.
Go, oh, you're training. They're like, okay, I'll get away. But it's probably not everyone.
No,
it
doesn't. What I like and what I see quite often now are the young dogs that want to chase Aspen and Flocka, and they're always just playing, and I never say anything, but I want to go, damn it, your dog is just playing, but my dog isn't. My dog is being prey. And, you know, so get your dog off of my dog. And usually what I do is just pick Flocka up and go, okay, and just go, you know, because I don't want to start any, I don't want... Actually, I want to keep that emotional balance. I don't want my dog to think that I am upset. Because if they think I'm upset, they're going to get more upset. And so I don't want that to happen.
Don't you love when you do that and then you start walking away and their dog follows you? And then they start yelling at you, wait.
I know. No, not going to wait.
Not my dog.
Can't wait. Oh, they do that, yeah. They go, my dog thinks he's a big dog. Who cares? He's not. He's little. He's little. Just because your dog thinks it's a big dog doesn't mean the other dogs don't have eyes. Yeah. All right. Okay, let's take a break, and then we're going to turn our chairs around, and we're going to be doing a consultation.